So, we're going to start out. So this is the very first discourse in this booklet on page 5, and it is called the Delightful Discourse. In Pali, it's the Pasadika Sutta. And this is from the Digha Nikaya, and Digha Nikaya is the long discourses of the Buddha. And there's five main collections of suttas. For those of you who are a little bit new to this, there is the long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, the Sanyutta Nikaya, and then there is the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya. And then you have the fifth collection called the Kudaka Nikaya, which means the small collection, and the small collection is the biggest of all the collections. It's true. It's weird, isn't it? It probably started out as small a long time ago, then it grew and grew and grew, and eventually it became enormous, and now it is almost as big as all the other collections put together. Not quite, but roughly, yeah, almost like that. So this is from the long discourses of the Buddha. This is called the Delightful Discourse, and it seems that this particular discourse, it took place towards the end of the Buddha's life. Many of the things in this discourse are like summaries of the Dhamma, where the Buddha explains a little bit like an overview of what the Dhamma is about. So I want to give this just by way of background, again, just to see what the suttas are all about and how they and why they are so important. So this is just a small extract from a very long sutta. And this is how it goes in English translation. This translation is by an Englishman called Maurice Walsh. And this translation is sometimes it's good, it's quite readable, but sometimes it's also not 100% accurate. So it's important to keep that in mind as well here. Anyway, it goes as follows. It was Udaka Ramaputta who used to say, "He sees but does not see. What is it that seeing one does not see? You can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge." That is what he meant by saying he sees, but does not see. He spoke in reference to a low, a common, not vulgar, but common, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. So here we have a person called Udaka Ramaputta. And for those of you who know the suttas well, and many of you know the suttas quite well, I know that some of you know them better than me sometimes. Sometimes I get a little message over the internet to help me remember what I'm supposed to remember when I give a Dhamma talk in Dhamma Loka Center in Perth. And that's what happened last Sunday. I was doing a sutta reading, and I couldn't remember a Pali word. And very helpfully, one of your wonderful members here sent that through to me in Perth. It was really nice, actually. It shows you how we can collaborate even far, from far distances around the world. That's what happens when you get a bit tired. You start forgetting things. Anyway, Udaka Ramaputta, he is quite well known in the suttas because he was one of the Buddha's first two teachers. We're going to have a look at this later on when we see the life of the Buddha and the leading up to his awakening experience. We're going to see his meeting with Udaka Ramaputta. So he's quite famous, and sometimes people have wondered, is he just fictional? Is he real? Did this person actually exist? Then you start to see him in other places in the suttas. Here he occurs in this sutta, and I think he may occur one other place in the suttas. And that gives you a feeling that these were real people who were spiritual teachers at that time and who people knew about. So it means that the Buddha, when he started his quest for awakening, he went to the most important spiritual teacher that existed at that time, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And both of those teachers are talked about elsewhere in the suttas. So here he is. But the problem with Udaka Ramaputta, you can see here, the Buddha is not all that impressed with him. He says that he has a saying, but the saying is just concerned with ordinary worldly things. You see, but you do not see. And he's talking about a razor blade. A razor blade, you can see the blade, but you cannot see the edge because the edge is so thin. The very edge is so kind of thin and narrow, you cannot actually see the edge properly. But that is about a low vulgar here. This is Pali word is a gamma. And Gamma literally means of the village, so it means ordinary, common. Vulgar is a kind of slightly pejorative term these days, this is not meant in a pejorative way. Low, you will notice here, low is the Pali word is hina. And this is an important point. Hina is a word that you find in the suttas, and it refers to, very often it refers to what is inferior. So, for example, they compare the monastic life to the lay life. I don't want to make any enemies here, but when they say that, they say when a monk or a nun returns to the lay life, they call it returning to the lower life. That's what they call it. I'm not trying to put you down. I'm just saying what it says in the suttas, and this is how the Buddha, how he called it. And it's important to remember, this is actually the meaning of this word. It means like low or inferior. So when the word Hinayana, for example, is used sometimes, it actually, what it refers to, it really refers to like the inferior vehicle. It also had a pejorative sense in a way. It's not used like that so much anymore, and we don't even use that word, but that is the original meaning of it. Worldly here is the word potujanika. Potujanika is the kind of the putu jana. Putu jana, jana means person, putu means many, it means the ordinary person. So relating, that which relates to the ordinary people. And of course, ignoble here is anarya. It does not relate to the noble ones. It's an ordinary thing here. These are all very interesting words. And the reason why they're interesting is because this is how the Buddha divides up the world into the lower things, which have to do with just the ordinary pleasures, and then compare to the higher pleasures that you're supposed to access via Dhamma practice. And all of these words actually occur in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta as well. And because of that, they have quite a bit of significance. That's why I mention them in this way. No spiritual significance means they're not, in Pali literally means anatta sanghita, literally means not connected with what is beneficial, or not connected with the goal being, of course, the real goal of life, the real purpose of life, the real meaning of life. This is one of the things I will get back to, and this is, I think, one of the really important things to kind of understand about the Buddha's teaching, which I have always found so incredibly inspiring and so important about Buddhism. Actually, not always, because when I started out as a Buddhist, I didn't really get this. So when people ask me why I became a Buddhist monk, sometimes I don't know what to say. I just shrug my shoulders. Somehow I ended up in these robes, and it's a bit of a miracle. I can maybe talk a little bit about that later on, but one of the reasons why I am now a Buddhist monk is because there became a point when I realized that the Buddhist teachings are the answer to the meaning of life. This is about the meaning of life. And once you kind of get that, and this is what it is saying in a sense here, anatta sanghita means connected with the goal. The goal here is what is really meaningful. Atta also means meaning, connected with that which is meaningful. So Buddhism is about the meaning of life. And of course, once you come to the meaning of life, you can't really say, okay, I'm going to reject the meaning and kind of go back to something which is meaningless. Yeah, you can't do that anymore. If you really get it, that the Buddhist teachings, as they were explained by the Buddha, are about what everybody is seeking. This is the core of what existence is about. It's an incredibly powerful thing, and in a sense, it makes you a Buddhist for life. You cannot turn your back to Buddhism anymore, because you found the meaning. You have to continue there. So this, to me, is one of those things that, you know, as Buddhists, we should really try to get across to people, both people who are Buddhist, people who haven't really thought much about Buddhism, but they kind of need a bit of a renewal in the Buddhist practice, but also people who are seeking for a spiritual path. Get this idea across that Buddhism gives you a realistic path, a realistic way of looking at life, which actually is the meaning of life itself. Because that is so inspiring and so important. And then you really start to commit to these teachings as a consequence. I'll talk more about this later on, because to me this is so significant and so fundamental to this whole practice. Okay. So, then the Buddha says, well, that is the wrong way of talking about that, He sees but does not see. So how is this expression used properly? If one were to use that expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a holy way of life. This is just the brahmacharya, which is successful and perfect, which is complete in all aspects, it would be a better way of putting this, complete in all aspects and complete and fulfilled in all aspects, yeah, something like that, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, nothing added, which is not necessary. Well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity. It is pure and well proclaimed. Yeah, this is what he sees. If he were to deduct anything from it, thinking in this way it will be more pure, he does not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking in this way it will be more complete, then he does not see it. That is the meaning of the saying, he sees but does not see. And so this is, to my mind, a very important statement about the teachings of the Buddha, where we should look for meaning, what actually matters. He starts off by saying here that the translation here is fully successful and perfect, but the Pali actually says sabbakara sampanna, sabbakara paripura, which means that it is complete and full in all aspects. That's really what it means. Yeah, so it is in all aspects it is complete. Yeah, so if he were to deduct anything from it in this way, it will be more pure. He does not see it. So this is one of these two points here, which is very important. Yeah, you cannot really take anything away from the teaching of the Buddha and say, now it is better, now it is more scientific, now it is doable, livable in the modern age. Yeah, in the modern age, we need to water things down a little bit, right? Because it's too difficult in the modern age to do all of these things. Jhana, forget about jhanas, because too difficult. Yeah, we all know that. Actually, we don't all know that, but some people know that. People know different things. I'm being a bit naughty, please forgive me if I say naughty things, because I'm just talking without thinking properly sometimes. And one should really be very careful with that, but sometimes that happens. So we cannot take anything out. Yeah, and this is one of the problems with so many aspects of modern Buddhism, starting, for example, with the mindfulness movement you see around the world. With the mindfulness movement that you see around the world, especially in the United States, they're taking out one aspect. Yeah, Buddhism has a Noble Eightfold Path. They're taking out one aspect and say, if you practice this one aspect, then your life will be better. And yes, it's probably true. It probably will be a bit better if you are more mindful, but you cannot actually expect to get the kind of results that you get in Buddhism by practicing one factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And in fact, it isn't even that one factor, because that is also, again, watered down to even a much lesser, it's not actually the full Satipatthana as it is, mindfulness as it is practiced in the suttas. It is much less than that. So that is very problematic, yeah, and I think they're starting to realize that, and the mindfulness movement has recently become more focused on virtue and morality to kind of, you know, boost the practice a little bit. Then there is things like right view. Yeah, the right view defined by the Buddha, and in the modern world people will say, yeah, or some of these aspects of right view, we don't really want to have anything to do with that, yeah. It is not the modern outlook, rebirth, all kind of things. Check it out, yeah, we don't want to have anything to do with that. But again, it is not kind of, you know, if you do that, you actually change the teaching dramatically. You don't have the same teaching anymore. Nothing is superfluous. Everything needs to be included. Then you have things like jhana practice. If someone says, oh, jhana is too difficult, well, it may be too difficult right now, yeah, because you haven't really made yourself ready by practicing all the other aspects of the path. But it's not that it's difficult. It's just that you haven't actually built up the causes, built up the foundation to be able to access the samadhi. These things are natural outcomes of the practice. They happen if you do things in the right way. They're not difficult as such. It's just that you have to kind of keep going with this, and eventually it happens. The wrong answer is to throw it out and say, yeah, too hard. That is always the wrong answer. This is what the Buddha is saying here. The right answer is to do the practice in the right way, and then it has to happen. So if you haven't experienced deep samadhi yet, yeah, some of you probably have, many of you probably not, but if you haven't, you know the answer is in how to apply yourself to the teachings in the right way. That is the right answer. So please remember, when we read the suttas, you can't throw anything out. Everything has to be included. The Noble Eightfold Path has 8 factors. That's why it's called eightfold, not called sevenfold, yeah, or sixfold or whatever. So please keep that in mind. And as you do so, then you will get it right. The other thing here, which it says here, which also is very, very interesting and very important for us to take on board, is that there is nothing lacking in the suttas. Yeah? All the aspects that are required for awakening are there. We don't need to add anything here. We don't really need any modern teachers. Yeah, you don't really need me to come here. Why am I here? That's the question. Maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe I should just go back to Perth again. You don't really need me because the information is right there in the suttas. The reason I am here is simply to try to kind of bring out the meaning of the suttas a little bit. Because when you start out, even when you get back, even when you have read the suttas for a while, it can be helpful to have someone to kind of just to draw out the meaning a little bit. But really, at the end of the day, the suttas are what you require, and I am superfluous. Wow. It's actually good to be superfluous. I can just go back to my cutie, yeah, and I can just, wow, relax. So actually, being superfluous is actually a good thing, yeah. So next year, Bobby, if I'm superfluous, just let me know and I'll see what happens. But it is actually a very important point. And one of the things, of course, that comes to mind straight away when we look at this is always the modern pursuit of things like the Abhidhamma studies. Is it really necessary to study the Abhidhamma? And the answer is that, from my point of view, the Abhidhamma is something that is superfluous to the suttas. It is a later philosophy that was built up after the Buddha passed away. And we know that. Sometimes people say that the Abhidhamma was spoken by the Buddha. But actually, once you understand a little bit about the history of Buddhism, once you read the Abhidhamma in the Pali language, sometimes you have to read it in Pali to really be able to see this. It actually is very clear that it is not the word of the Buddha. Because the vocabulary is different, the style is different, everything is different. If you compare the Abhidhamma across the various schools, it is very different between the various schools of Buddhism. Yeah, there are many schools of Buddhism that came from ancient India, the Savastivada school, Dharmaguptaka. They all had their own Abhidhammas, and those Abhidhammas are still exist to some extent in the present day. Many of them are found in Chinese translation, ancient Chinese. Yeah, I don't know, maybe some of you have read the Agamas, the suttas in ancient Chinese. It's very difficult, even if you can read modern Chinese, to read ancient Chinese actually is quite difficult because the characters have evolved and they have a different meaning often at that time than they have now. But I know some people who can read the ancient Chinese suttas. So they are changed, yeah? These are different. The Abhidhamma across the different traditions is different, and that shows us that these are things that arose after the schools had separated quite a long time after the time of the Buddha. So the Abhidhamma is not the word of the Buddha. So is it wrong? Well, it doesn't. I think it's the wrong question to ask whether the Abhidhamma is wrong or right. More important question is to ask, is it necessary here? Yeah, that is a more important question. And the answer is not really. The Abhidhamma is very often an expansion on the suttas. It adds new things. It is a kind of trying to make the suttas complete, filling all the gaps, filling in all the holes, trying to make a complete philosophical system. And of course, there is a reason why the Buddha didn't make that complete philosophical system in the first place. Probably because it wasn't possible, it wasn't necessary, because the Buddha's path is a pragmatic one. We have a problem. We're not here to make philosophy, we are here to overcome a problem that we all have, the problem of suffering here. So I would advise you, if you are interested in Abhidhamma and you want to learn a little bit, please do so. But I wouldn't really advise you to focus too much on that, because there is plenty to read in the suttas. Yeah, the suttas are about that much to read. Has anyone here read all the suttas already? They weigh in? Why in?
Doesn't matter.
And even if you have read all the suttas, then start from the beginning again. Because once you get to the end of that much, you have forgotten what was in the beginning, so then you have to go back to the beginning again. So you have to read through. So there is enough in the suttas. I have read all the suttas several times in Pali and English and everything, and still, when I read the suttas, this is one of the reasons why I like to teach this. Then when I read them, I discover new things in there, even after I've been a monk now for 23 years, something like that, and been studying the suttas for 25 years, and still I see new things in there. So the point is, there is enough there of the word of the Buddha to keep you going for this lifetime. We don't need to branch out into all of these other things that are not really core to the teachings. But of course, if you I'm not saying you should never study these other things. If you have a little bit of interest, you want to have a look at it, please do so. And hopefully it will turn you off very quickly here. That's what happened to me. I started reading Abhidhamma. I thought, oh, this is just so boring. I don't know why anyone reads this. That was my feeling about the Abhidhamma. But people are different, so make up your own mind about that. And the same is true about so many other things in Buddhism. Yeah, the Mahayana Suttas, for example. Sometimes they are nice. Sometimes they agree with early Buddhism. Sometimes they don't. But we know that they came quite a long time after the Buddha. The commentaries, the Visuddhimagga, all of that is the same. So you can have a look at that a little bit, but know where to keep your focus. That is really what I'm saying here. So nothing is missing in the suttas, nothing is superfluous. It's a very powerful teaching, and it has really important consequences for where we should look for truth and how we should approach the word of the Buddha. Of course, the question always arises, what exactly is that word of the Buddha? And this is what comes up next here, so that we can focus more clearly on those things. So the Buddha says this is the meaning of he sees, but he does not see. Yeah, you don't see anything superfluous, you don't see anything missing. That is the meaning of that. Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any spiritual life, the brahmacharya, as being fully successful and perfect, in other words, being complete in all aspects and fulfilled in all aspects, it is this holy life, the Buddha's holy life, that they would be describing. So the Buddha is kind of making a lion's roar. Yeah, this is the holy life. Here, everything is perfect. Then he says, therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths, these teachings that I have realized through my own knowledge, you should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this brahmacharya, this holy life, may continue and be established for a long time, for the profit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, profit, and happiness of devas and humans. Let's just stop there, first of all. So these truths, this is literally these dhammas that I have taught you. Dhammas here means teachings. So these teachings I have taught you, and of course one of the important qualifiers of the teachings of the Buddha is that he has realized them by his own knowledge. Which is abhinya, yeah. So you have realized them through direct knowledge. So all the teachings in the suttas are not theoretical, they come from the Buddha's insight. And of course that is why they are so powerful, because they come from a direct understanding of the nature of the world. And that is what makes the Buddha's teaching so special. They're not faith-based, they're not doctrine for the sake of doctrines. They actually come from a direct realization. And everything he teaches is really based on that. And then he says, you should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning. And this is one of those important little things. You don't see it many places in the suttas. But here you can see the idea of how to keep these teachings alive for the future, how that is laid down by the Buddha from the very beginning. You come together, often in groups, and this of course here refers mostly to the monks, maybe to some extent also to the nuns would also do this perhaps, although the nuns are not mentioned all that much in the suttas, but probably they also are included in this. And so you come together and recite. And of course the purpose of that is that when you come together as a group and you recite these things, then if one person makes a mistake, then the overall group will correct that mistake. Yeah. And this is how then you actually keep these things memorized and how you pass them on from one generation to the next ones. The young monks will be there, they will listen to the recitation, and as they listen to it, they will also learn these things. And it goes on from one generation to the next one, from one country to the next one, eventually ending up in Malaysia, eventually ending up in Australia, and this is kind of the nice thing, and this is what the Buddha talks about when he says the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana. Dhamma Chakka is the wheel, Pavattana is setting in motion, and the Dhamma is the teaching. So it's setting in motion the wheel of the teaching. It's like it rolls on in the world from one time to another one, from one generation to the next, from one culture to the next one, so that people across the world get access to these things. But to be able to do that, you have to lay down a system of propagation, and this is that system. You recite it together. It was laid down by the Buddha from the very beginning. And this is important because very often people, they have doubts about whether the teachings as we have them now can be the same as what the Buddha actually spoke. And it is a reasonable doubt, 2,500 years, 2,500 years, how is that possible? Surely there's nothing left of the original teachings. This is all kind of just made up about by later generations or something like that. And maybe there's a kind of a glimpse of something laid down by the Buddha. But actually, I don't think so, because it was a very conservative tradition from the beginning. The word of the Buddha, the Buddha Vachana, was always raised to be something special, and it was conserved in this way. And there was a very powerful model that already existed in India at this time, because remember, in Indian society, they had it was a Brahmanical society, where the Vedas, the Upanishads, the ancient texts of Indian society, already had existed for a couple of thousand years, or at least 1,500 years before the time of the Buddha. And those Vedas, we know that they were transmitted very, very accurately over 1,000 years before the Buddha. They know that through the analysis of these texts. So they already had a system for collecting and keeping these things in memory. So the Buddhists, they just they use some of the same techniques. And we know they use some of the same techniques because some of the suttas are arranged in parallel ways to how the ancient Vedas were arranged, in numerical series according to groups and all these kind of things. Early Buddhists, they used the technology of reciting, the technology of memory that already existed in ancient India. And this is what you see here in this particular context, whereby you come together. So for that reason, I think there is a good grounds for thinking that actually the suttas were transmitted very accurately over very long periods of time, because there was a very powerful part of Indian culture, this ability to remember things and carry them on from one generation to the next one. And so this is one part of that. Another part of that, for those of you who are a little bit newer to the suttas, I talk about these things a little bit on every retreat, but we also know that the suttas were very accurately recited. We know that through a comparative study of the suttas. One of the very interesting things about the early Buddhism is that very soon after the Buddha, the Buddhism divided up into schools. So if you think that there's no harmony in Buddhism today, it goes back to the very beginning. There's never been full harmony in Buddhism. Yeah, always there's been arguments within the Buddhist community. So we try our very best to have harmony, but you also see how it is human nature a little bit to split and to divide and to argue about things. It seems to be impossible to have absolute harmony. So we shouldn't really expect that. We try our best, but then we also kind of accept it if it turns out to be very hard. It goes back to the very beginning. And at the beginning, Buddhism started to divide up into various schools. Some of the important schools were the Sarvastivada school. Another important one was the Mahasanghika, yeah, means the greater Sangha. Another important one was what later on became the Theravada Buddhism, yeah, which went on to Sri Lanka and also other parts of India. And had the Dharmaguptaka school, also quite an important one, very closely related to the Theravada school. And these schools, they existed already probably around the time of Ashoka. Ashoka existed about 150 years after the Buddha. And once these schools had been established, they had their area in India where they were prominent. So the Theravadins obviously went to the south of India and to Sri Lanka. Yeah, we know that. The Sarvastivadins, they went to the north of India, and also the Dharmaguptakas went to the north of India, and that is where they became prominent. And from the north of India, they followed then the Silk Road into China. And that is how Buddhism came to China originally, starting around the year zero on the Christian calendar. So maybe about 400 years after the Buddha is when it started to trickle into China. And after a while, it became a flood of Buddhism entering into China. And that is how Buddhism eventually became one of the main spiritual directions in China, in addition to the traditional Chinese, you know, Confucianism and Taoism and these things. And then you also had the Buddhism became an important part of Chinese culture as well after that. But what is interesting about this is that these schools, they're separated very far apart. And the Theravadin scriptures were kept in Sri Lanka in the Pali language. The Sarvastivadin scriptures, then they went to China, were translated into Chinese. Yeah, And it's exactly the same suttas. They call the Agamas in Chinese, they call the Agamas in Sanskrit, and that is the word that is translated into Chinese. So they are very, very far apart, thousands of kilometers apart, yeah, having separated about 2,300 years ago. And then you take those suttas, which originally came from the same source, and you compare them. Yeah, you could look at the Madhyama Agama, yeah, which is the Sanskrit name, which exists in the Agamas in Chinese translation. You take the Nikayas in Pali, and you compare them, and lo and behold, those suttas are, to a large extent, in some places, almost identical. Not always exactly the same, because you can't expect that over so long periods of time. But in some cases, almost identical. Things like the jhana formulas, one of the really critical things in Buddhism, that describe what the jhana is, are the first and second jhana are verbatim the same. If you translate the Chinese, look at the Chinese and compare it to the Pali, it looks like it is verbatim the same. Which is quite astonishing, yeah? Word for word the same. And if you look at the suttas overall, things like the gradual training, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, and all of these things, again, it is almost exactly the same in the ancient Chinese as it is compared to the Pali. And that is what that shows us, is how conservative the various schools of Buddhism were, how careful they were in looking after the word of the Buddha, how important it was to them. Yeah, they really strove really, really hard to make sure this was kept intact. It wasn't distorted by later generations, but kept intact. And we can say that about 2,300 years, and it's only 150 years before that, we go back to the time of the Buddha, and we can assume that that last period back to the Buddha also, they would have been very conservative, because conservatism seems to have been inherent to the schools. So where did it come from? It must have come from the very earliest time, from suttas like this, where people are supposed to come together and recite these teachings, yeah, and make sure they are available for later generations. And this is so uplifting, because what it means is that when later on, when we come to the suttas, and it won't be long now before we get to them, you know, this is actually part of the suttas as well, but when we come to the more teaching suttas, when you read that, remember, you are reading the word of the Buddha himself. This is so powerful. And not only are you reading the word of the Buddha, but as I mentioned just a second ago, the Buddha, when he started out giving these teachings, he knew that there would be people in the future. I don't know if he knew about the BGF specifically, or Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth. I don't know if he knew about that, but he knew that there would be people in the future who would be listening to these teachings. That's why he used an expression like the Dhamma Chakka Pavartana, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, because he knew it would travel from one culture to another one, from one generation to the next, moving out into the world, because these teachings are so powerful. They touch the very heart of what it is to be a human being. They are about the meaning of life. When people get it, they will be interested. Just like me, I came from this really cold country far away. So, but still, you know, if you are human, you get it, then bang, it kind of has some kind of significance for you straight away. So because of that, remember, the Buddha thought about us. He thought about the later generations. When he gave these teachings, he gave them in a language that is accessible and understandable to everyone. He used universal terminology, psychology that is true for all human beings. So when you read this, he's talking to you. He's talking to me. He's talking to every one of us. So kind of when you get that, the Buddha is actually talking to you, it's almost like the Buddha is in front of you when you're reading the suttas. That makes them far more powerful. It makes you kind of your hair stand on end. If you have hair, if you haven't got hair, it's problematic. But if you have hair, then it makes your hair stand on end a little bit. It's like, whoa, it's like electric. It's like very, very powerful. And this is the right way of thinking about the suttas. You are in the presence of the Buddha. You are in the presence of the greatest spiritual master in human history. Whoa. Just that buzzing when you get that. So this is so important when we approach the suttas, because you want to read them with feeling, with emotion, not just as a dry document, black on white, but something which really matters to you, something which goes to your heart, not just to your intellect. Maybe initially it will go mostly to your intellect, because it can be difficult to access that maybe emotion straight away. But a very important part of this is the emotional aspect. Buddhism without emotion is dry and empty. Buddhism is about joy. Buddhism is about happiness. Real meditation is about joy and happiness. Only when you get access to these things does Buddhism really start to have a meaning. That is what they do. They come and recite it together, to keep it going for future generations, including us here, gathered here together now, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression. Expression means the word, the actual word of the sutta. The meaning means the intention of that word, what that word is pointing to. So he is saying here that both having the expression right and having the meaning right is more important. Of course, the meaning is much more important than the expression, but if the expression gets too distorted, after a while you lose the meaning as well. That's why both of them matter. But in the end, the meaning is the most important thing. And that's why we try to be careful in analyzing the suttas carefully to make sure we get the right meaning. We're not too quick in making judgments about the suttas. Without dissension, without arguing, if there is dissension, there are other suttas where the Buddha shows us how to deal with dissension so that we can come to understanding what is the right teaching here. In order that this brahmacharya can continue and last for a long time, 2,500 years at least, maybe longer, for the profit and happiness of the many. This is the purpose of the Dhamma, is for it to be of benefit, to be of happiness for each one of us. One of the things that I have often noticed about Buddhists are often very keen on promoting the Dhamma to others. Yeah, we often wonder, oh yeah, because Dhamma is so great, we want to promote it to others. But remember, the Dhamma is really only meaningful if you practice it yourself. You have to go first, yeah? And you have to kind of practice these teachings so that you reap some benefit. Because if all you do want to do is convert others, then it doesn't really have any effect on your own life. So what's the point? The whole point is that it is to be for the benefit of each one of us. So teaching others and practicing these teachings should always go hand in hand. Or at the very least, if you want to choose one of them, it's better to practice it for yourself and not teach others than just to teach others and not practice it yourself. So practicing it yourself should have a high priority. Otherwise, it is kind of the whole thing becomes kind of pointless. Everyone teaches someone else, but nobody actually does the practice. So out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans, even devas reap happiness and profit and benefit out of the Dhamma. And people often say, oh, I want to be reborn as a human in my next life. But actually, being reborn as a deva, you might get the Dhamma there as well, yeah, which is kind of cool. So you don't have to be, you can actually go and chill a little bit in the deva realm and relax and still learn the Dhamma, which is kind of nice. Just very briefly, I will just finish off this passage before we take a little break. What are the things that you should recite together? What are these teachings that are the real Dhamma? Yeah? And this is, of course, very exciting, because what they are the following four things. The four applications of mindfulness. Foundations of mindfulness is no good as a translation. The four applications of mindfulness, or perhaps the four establishings of mindfulness. The four right efforts, the four aspects of spiritual power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. These are the Dhamma of the Buddha. Elsewhere, they are said to be the Dhamma of the Buddha. This is the essence of his teaching. And these things are called as a group. They're not called as such in the suttas. They occur as group in the suttas in many places. But in the commentary, these are called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Bodhipakkhya means on the side. Pakka means like wing. A bird has a pakka as a wing. It means the side of something. These are the 37 things on the side of awakening. In other words, the 37 aids to awakening, if you like. Yeah, this is the teaching of the Buddha. And this is what I'm going to focus on next weekend. You may have seen, if you had a look at the suttas, I'm going to have a look at the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Why? Now you know why. Because these are the essence of the Buddha's teachings. So I'm going to talk about those next weekend. And what is interesting about these things, if you look at that group, they are all practical things. They're all about the path. They're about what we need to do. The Buddhist practice is a practice that is pragmatic, practical. It is about achieving a certain goal. It is not a philosophy. It is not just a theoretical thing. It is a very, very practical thing. And this you get straight away. That is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. It is not just practical, because nothing can be just practical. Even a practice has to have a framework. We have to know why we do the practice. Yeah, so that's why you have a little bit of framework. You have things like the Four Noble Truths about suffering. You have things like dependent origination. You have things like right view. And these give the framework within which the practice is to be done. Without the framework, the practice is meaningless. We have to know why we're doing the practice. That was the point. Just practice. What do you mean just practice? I want to know why I'm practicing. Well, actually, it is to become happy and overcome suffering. Okay, that's good enough. I will do the practice. Sometimes that's all the framework you need, yeah? This is to overcome suffering, is to become happy, yeah? And then you are in business. But sometimes you need a bit more than that. You need things like right view. You need things like dependent origination. And that's actually also included within the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Why? Because the Noble Eightfold Path starts with right view. Right view has the Four Noble Truths in it. The Four Noble Truths has the origin of suffering and the cessation of suffering, the second and third noble truth, and they are dependent origination. The origin of suffering is dependent origination. The ending of suffering is dependent cessation, which is like the reverse of dependent origination. Yeah, so it's right there within the four noble truths, within the Eightfold Path. So it actually belongs to that as well. So that is the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. I'm not going to talk more about that now because I will save that for the last part of the retreat. So now those of you who are not coming to the last part, you can regret that you're not coming to this last part. Really exciting stuff, yeah? No, please don't regret anything because everything is more or less the same. Yeah, it's just different angles on the same teachings. So I just like to be a bit naughty because my teacher is Ajahn Brahm. I have been taught how to be naughty when in his talks. That's why. Anyway, so let us have a 15-minute break, and then we'll come back again at about 9:30 here.